are listening to the Mythmaker Podcast Network.
Hello. I'm delighted to welcome you to another episode of the Joseph Campbell Foundation's flagship podcast, Pathways with Joseph Campbell. I'm your host, Bradley Olson. On this podcast, we share archived audio lectures given by Joseph Campbell over the course of his teaching and lecturing career. On this episode of Pathways, we're listening to a lecture from 1976 entitled Mythologies, New, Old, and Today. There isn't a great deal of information regarding the location and audience for this lecture, only a notation suggesting that this lecture was delivered at the Blaisdell Institute. From what I've been able to put together, the Blaisdell Institute for Advanced Study in World Cultures and Religions began in 1956 and was affiliated with the Claremont School of Theology in Claremont, California. The Blaisdell Institute no longer seems to be active. I did phone the Claremont School of Theology, hoping that they could provide me with some of the Institute's history and even give me an idea of the type of guest speakers they would have invited to lecture, in addition to Joseph Campbell. Alas, the Claremont School of Theology has not yet responded to my request, but regardless, the lecture we're about to listen to is, I think, a particularly good one. In this lecture, we'll hear Professor Campbell address the relevance of mythology today and issues that are frequently raised in regard to myth, such as, what is the modern mythology? What will the myths of the future be? Can we create new myth? He begins his lecture by reflecting on his life. At this point, he's 72 years old, a life spent in the study of myth. There can be no mistaking his passion, and you can hear the gratitude and wonder in his voice as he comments on the remarkably enriching experience, the marvel of discovery, as he put it, that his life in myth has been. After all those years of observing human behavior regarding myth and ritual, Professor Campbell is not despairing, nor is he pessimistic about humanity. And he notes near the end of his lecture that people are realizing more and more that developing compassion is the key to a meaningful experience of life. I think opening to compassion is exactly what Robert Kennedy intended when he quoted Aeschylus on the night of Martin Luther King's murder, only a short 8 years before Campbell's lecture. Kennedy said, quote, "But we have to make an effort in the United States. We have to make an effort to understand, to get beyond, or go beyond these rather difficult times," unquote. I believe that what Kennedy called an effort to understand is the same thing as learning to be compassionate. For it's compassion that will, as RFK says at the end of his speech, tame the savageness of man and make gentle the life of this world. I often hear the question, how can one use myth in contemporary life? Well, one highly effective way to use myth is to take advantage of its powerfully consoling nature, its inherent sympathy to the human condition. And I can't think of a more eloquent, more moving, more exemplary way to use myth than the way Robert Kennedy used it that night in Indianapolis, only a few short months before his own murder, to help the thousands in the audience grieve while simultaneously consoling and comforting them, as well as himself. This lecture is one of my favorites in Professor Campbell's repertoire, and I'm sure you'll enjoy hearing him discuss the subject that has, since he was a little boy, filled him with such delight and wonder, and even at the age of 72, still evoked those same feelings. Perhaps we can take a lesson from him in that regard, too. When we join our life's work with our passions, our bodies may age, but we never grow old. And with that in mind, I believe you'll enjoy Joseph Campbell's lectures on mythologies, old, new, and today, from 1976. And immediately following his talk, I'll be back with some final remarks and talk about some of the important and interesting ideas from the lecture. And now, Here's Joseph Campbell.
The whole matter of mythology has been my principal concern throughout the greater part of my life. And the marvel of encountering almost identical themes under the various inflections of the very great civilizations, that all of which have grown out of mythological thinking, has been an extremely enriching experience. One is acquainted through these scholarly enterprises with the great traditional mythologies, and then in teaching students, one becomes aware of the problems of people in this contemporary moment, when we are in, as it were, a sort of terminal moraine of mythological thinking. The civilization is no longer founded on mythological ideas, but is essentially economic, political in its base. Now, this is both a great advantage and a somewhat baffling disadvantage. The great advantage is that one is allowed to have one's own thoughts, that one is allowed to live according to one's own myth, that the psychological origins of mythology within oneself, rather than taking warmed over and applied mythic themes from your preceptors, who then see to it that you adhere to their particular dogmas. And so there's, in my experience of students and of my friends in my own life, I find that there is a proliferation of what might be called potential mythologies in every person today. When people ask me what is the myth today, I always have the feeling there is no myth. There can be no myth anymore. A mythology requires a homogeneous population, a group of people within a horizon who will have had equivalent experiences, for whom certain specific images will continue to have, and dependably so, the same sense, the same meaning, the same affect value. Whereas in our world, with a great miscellany of people in this room, I dare say there are so many different backgrounds to the people here that your responses to images would be quite particular to yourselves. So each of us is, as it were, thrown into the requirement to develop out of his own depth, to learn what his own driving grounds are. And you can't take them from elsewhere. So within a secular frame, so to say, we have this movement of creative, it's like a garden where the plants are growing. And nevertheless, there are certain radical and fundamental transformations of thought that are cutting across the whole field and touching us all. And it's with those that I decided I might commence this evening to broach this great problem of the interior life of man today and how it relates to the traditional themes that we have all been brought up on one way or another in our earlier days. It's impossible, it seems to me, to talk about mythology today without considering the impact of these great flights to the moon. I'll never forget that moment a couple of years ago when that first footprint of man came down on that planet. It was sensational, yes, but it was more than that. It seemed to me that the press, the mass media, just missed the point entirely. There was only one of the great periodicals that, with which I became acquainted, that seemed to me to catch the sense of this at all. And that was an Italian pictorial periodical, Epoca, E-P-O-C-A. There was there a fabulous visual representation of the marvel of this great event. And the kernel, and I dare say this is the man who was responsible for the whole thing, the nuclear point was a wonderful little Italian poet named Giuseppe Ungaretti. He was a man, I would say, in his 70s or so, and he was shown with an enthusiastic look on his face, pointing to his television screen, and he said, "This night is such a night as never existed in the world." And then he wrote a little two-line poem to, not the moon, but the earth. the Earth rising as a glorious, glorious planet over that desert horizon of the moon. And this is his little poem in my free and easy translation. What are you doing, Earth in heaven? Tell me, what are you doing, silent Earth? Stand on the moon? The Earth is in heaven. Stand on the Earth? The moon is in heaven. I remember some time ago, Carl Jung writing of the dogma of the assumption of the Virgin bodily to heaven, said this was the most important theological doctrine of the present millennium. It had been, of course, an article of faith for many, many centuries. But to have been declared a dogma that earth matter, the body of a living woman, had gone and been crowned in heaven, had implied, whether the poor Pope meant it or not, that there is an equivalence here of what had always been separate in our culture world, spirit and matter. And when you consider all of the old mythologies, the lights of the heavens operate according to different laws from our own. But here was Earth up there, not only the Virgin, but an astronaut walking on this first of the heavenly spheres. There's a wonderful line. I don't know whether it was intentional that this should have been implied in the name of our craft, the Apollo, in Dante's Divine Comedy. At that point where he proposes to set off from the earthly paradise to the moon. And he says, O you who in your little craft have been wishing to follow, do not dare this venture now. I go beyond all bounds and am guided by the circling stars of the bears and Minerva's breath and the light of Apollo. The coincidence is rather charming, but there Dante was moving from earthly to spiritual realms. We have gone past that. Now, when you think of the proposition that Kant proposed, how is it that in this place, right here, I can calculate mathematical relationships which I know will be valid over there? How is it that we on Earth could have calculated to a iota the mathematics that would carry our men to the moon where no one had ever been before? That the mathematics of the human mind work out there. And we know that they're going to work wherever the planets are, or the stars. That is to say, man has in his own mentality wrapped himself around the universe. Think what this is doing mythologically. This is the point I'm trying to make. There is no longer that dual situation, nor is the lead from there to here. The lead is from here to there. That is to say, man is the center. This is a terrific situation. It was in 1543 that Copernicus published his heliocentric thesis. This was the first time in the history of man that a cosmology was announced, which was purely conceptual. It was not what you saw. All the older mythologies speak of the sun is rising and setting. We are in the stable place, and it is the world of the sky that is revolving, not so in Copernicus. And here, from the moon, this photograph of the Earth, we are, as some have said, spaceship Earth flying now, spinning wildly. And we realize how small the Earth, how perilous our position, so to say. And we realize that it's one Earth. Not only that, but our airplanes. I can hardly believe it. Yesterday, this thing always astounds me. I'm in New York, And I say to my wife, bye-bye, Jean, I'm having dinner in Los Angeles. And sure enough, a couple of more miles and I would have been in Japan or India. It is now one very tiny planet. And think what this involves mythologically. What are you going to do with your hate? All of the old traditions, and I say all, have said love belongs with the in-group, and we project our aggression outward. There's no outside anymore. This conflict, which has been recognized in all societies forever, between the aggression and the principle of the erotic, thanatos and eros, has been solved by projecting the other outside and inventing demons out there that you will be justified in annihilating. It won't go anymore. Yet we still do have mythologies all over the place of ours is the one true. Oh, yes, as one of my Hindu friends said, you Christians say you worship God in your way and we worship God in his. This attitude is one that just won't do anymore either. And so there's this fantastic problem of really effectively achieving a psychological quenching of the pathological hate principle through the principle of love. And this now is acute. We talk about ecology and pollution, well, there's a psychological pollution also that has to be handled, and we see it in this vision of the beautiful Earth. I remember the curious experience a couple of Christmas Eves ago, before the first man stepped on the moon, of hearing the first verses of the book of Genesis quoted by the three astronauts who were then flying around the moon one Christmas Eve. And I thought, what a grotesque incongruity. These men quoting this sort of 4,000-year-old cosmology, which they, in their very presence, now have refuted, coming down. And this coming down through the air to us, through this other marvelous thing, the television. And I was curious, being somewhat scholarly and inquisitive, to ask my friends thereafter, how did that affect you? Oh, we thought it was so wonderful. Everybody had this wonderful experience. And I thought, well, what a pity that they hadn't found Dante, or that Ungaretti perhaps hadn't written his poem yet, something that was adequate from our own poetic life to the cosmology in which we live and which makes the little thing in the book of Genesis look like something for children. The astronauts themselves, coming down, issued the first words of the new poetry. I remember they said that the planet Earth looked like an oasis in the desert of space. I remember they were asked, who is navigating the craft now? And they answered, Newton. This is it. Now that, I think, is one of the big things that's cutting across. Copernicus's cosmology is not only conceptual now, it has presented its first images. We've seen it, we've experienced it. It has become an affect image, an image with some impact on the psyche, not simply in the brain, because myths and mythic images talk to the psyche. The next big thing, I think, that is happening right now, I don't know how many would agree with this, is the this tremendous influence of the psychedelic drugs. We've always known that there was an inner life. It has been for those who addressed themselves to it or who had it come upon them. But this has become a mass phenomenon now. Not that the inner life that is experienced in this sort of fun, mystic way is necessarily, or in any sense, necessarily equivalent to the great religious experiences of the people whose whole lives have been absorbed in the quest for God. But it has been like a tourist trip to to great cities and great worlds, a little glimpse, and one knows it's there. This I find among the students all over the country, this tremendous realization that there is an answer inside, there is a waiting consciousness inside, which our empirical, practical minds simply diminish. And now, with these consciousness-transforming experiences, I come back again. It is there. There's no doubt about it. Another part of the story is represented in the really serious medical attention that is being given to these matters right now. Since way back, I received only a couple of days ago from Dr. Stanislav Grof, who is a Czechish psychiatrist, has worked in using LSD as a medium for psychiatric cures, giving people as many as 90 shots until they broke up their whole inside and came out again reborn. And there it appears that this is a very serious realization on the part of empirical science of these depths and the possibilities of consciousness. And the thing that all of them are bringing out is the analogy, at any rate, to the great mythological themes. And the reason Dr. Grof sent this paper of his to me, it's a big thing, about 400 pages, was that he had found that these mythological images that people perceive and send forth when they speak of what their experiences are corresponded to those of the myths that I had many years ago brought together in The Hero with a Thousand Faces. Only a few years ago, I received from Dr. John Perry in San Francisco a discussion of his findings with respect to schizophrenia, the imagery of the schizophrenic, and these correspond also to the imageries of myth. It is now evident that at least the most part of the great mythic themes, which were thought to be visions from beyond, just as the lights of the sky were thought to represent powers out there, and laws from out there, these visions also come from the psyche. So as our minds and its form of space have embraced the universe, so it is from our own psyches that those divine guiding beings that have inspired the civilizations of the world have really come. And I would say that the great theme shift in the modern world is from supernatural to human centers. And Jung has remarked this in his discussion for many years, he noticed, of the mandalas, as he called them, that were brought forth by his patients, these coordinating, you might say, psychological symbols within the center of these circles, these balanced circles, the high symbol of the person's highest concern. No longer were they divinities. No longer were they abstract symbols of the divine. They were figures that represented some aspect of the human psyche and of man. So the first big shift, I would say, has been from any plea to supernatural intervention to man's own interior. And it is this, of course, that has brought in the whole Indian and Buddhist material into the center of our contemporary field of concern. Because in those worlds, ever since the time of the old Upanishads from about the 8th century BC, it has been realized, and this is a fundamental dictum of the Oriental thinking, all the gods are within you. All the heavens, all the hells, their demons and divinities. They are counterparts of your own interior dream world. The dream consciousness, and here's another thing that comes out in this LSD thing, the realization that waking consciousness is relative and dream consciousness is relative. And while the dream laws prevail and are valid there, these laws prevail and are valid here, they are different worlds. The world of gross objects illuminated from without, where subject and object are separate from each other. The world of dream, where the subject and object are identical, the objects are self-luminous. This is the world of the heavenly beings. And who are the heavenly beings? They are the personifications of those dynamic driving powers within ourselves. Now, there's another matter that becomes more and more apparent as one reads the discussions and statements of people who've had these interior experiences when they try to say what it is they've experienced. They're always using religious images, but the religious images come from all over the map. Egypt plays a very big role. India plays a very big role. Buddhist figures, usually sloppy, they don't really know what they mean, but the reference is to these fields. We're in, as I say, a kind of terminal moraine of grandiose mythologies with structured civilizations. Those structures are giving way now to a single global economic situation, which has become terribly serious in purely mechanical and physical terms. And nevertheless, here's all this other material that is now serving individuals to piece together their own uninstructed psyches, you might say. That's the first point about the contemporary mythological world. Now, what do I mean by a myth? Well, the best definition of a myth I know is mythology is other people's religion. This will give you a sense of its importance. What, however, is religion? Religion, I would say, is misunderstood mythology. And now, what is the difference? The difference is, typically, that in the religious traditions, the symbols are interpreted as facts, as historical facts. And in mythology, the emphasis is on the affect value, the emotional impact of the image. A mythological image is an energy evoking and directing signal that works of itself. Then you can begin to think about it. The thought comes later. But in theological instruction, the thought is attached to the image, and the image may be telling you something else entirely. And it is particularly unfortunate, when the history that has been attached to the myths is disproven by scholarship, which is exactly, of course, what has happened to our mythologies. There was no Garden of Eden. There was no flood. There was no this. There was no that. There may not even have been an exodus from Egypt. What are you going to do with this when all of your symbology is attached to facts on the outside? Symbols come from your own psyche. They are the vehicles of communication between your unconscious and your conscious systems. When they have been interpreted out there so that your consciousness refutes them, you are left without a connecting line. It's as though someone cut a telephone line. And then people feel rootless, lost, their own interior source of balance and ground of being has been taken away from them. So now let me just say a word about this strange being, man, and then a word about some of the earlier mythologies, and I'll come back to the contemporary world again. Man is the unformed animal. A lion can be only a lion. A tiger can be only a tiger. A man can be doctor, lawyer, Indian chief, rich man, poor man, beggar man, thief. And we in these different roles are as different from each other as various animals. Furthermore, as Schopenhauer points out, the difference between one human being and another is as great as the difference between any two animal species. We are unique creatures. And how do we find our shapes? We find our shapes by imitating others. One of the most curious things about human beings is this business of making believe he's something and through that coming to a knowledge of himself. Primitive people imitate the animals. All of their religions have as their ritual lore the totemistic animal dance. Let's say the people who live by killing animals. The people who live in the plant world imitate the plant. You bury a seed and the plant grows. You bury a human being, he'd be born again. These images are derived from the environment through very intense imitation. One identifies These identifications with animals and plants are one of the phenomena that continually recur in the LSD sessions also. People do imagine themselves to be animals and can even intend to do so. One of the most striking illustrations in my life of the force of the power of imitation and identification came when I drove up to a curb one day in New York, and there was a little boy standing there. I'd say he was about 11 years old, and he was standing in a very stiff posture. And he said, you can't stop here. And I said, well, why not? I looked to see if there were any signs saying no. And I said, well, why not? He said, I'm a hydrant. And the identification for the time, at any rate, he took very seriously. Sometimes when I see clergy dressed up as divinities, I wonder how far they're pushing that thing, too. The whole religious life of man has been this make-believe of imagining it is so and relating to it. And what the youngster did, of course, was project his own psyche out there and was playing this role. In the history of mankind, mythology is coeval with man. The earliest knowledge we have of Homo sapiens, even Homo just a bit proto-sapiens, Homo neanderthalensis, shows already burials with grave gear indicating a motif of rebirth. Worship of cave bear skulls showing a relationship to the animal world on which these people were living. Then when we come to the great caves of Cro-Magnon man, the fantastic things, these shamans in animal costumes, reconciling the human community with the animals that they have to kill. And then in the plant world, people derive from plants. Half of the myths of the equatorial zone tell of people coming forth from plant world. And then with the emergence of the great civilizations of ancient Sumer in the 4th millennium BC, the priests suddenly realized that the planets are moving at a mathematical rate through the fixed stars. And there, 3500 BC, is the first concept of a cosmic order and the notion that the universe must tell man how to live. And you have the kings wearing the horns of the moon, the queens the garment of the planet Venus, and the little courts enacting the mimes of the heavenly spheres, imitating the planets. As many of you know, that excavation by Sir Leonard Woolley in the 20s at the great ziggurat of Ur, the ziggurat of the moon god. Whole courts buried in ceremonial attire, buried alive, because at a certain juncture of the planets, the eon ended, and the court that represented it must have ended also. These were great games that people played. Civilization began as a game of this kind. And then we come to our own day, and something is happening now that is no less important than what happened in that day of the crisis, when people moved from the non-literate plant and animal to the literate game of the heavens. Let me say a word finally now about the functions that mythologies have served in the past, and let's see if we can say something about the function they must serve today, now, here in the West. One can't speak for other worlds from this standpoint of the West. I want to speak only of our own problem. Mythology in the traditional society serves four basic functions. The first function is that of alerting and awakening in the individual a sense of awe before the mystery dimension of being. And this is a motif that is pointed out also in the psychedelic experiences. One of the most prominent responses is the sense of the having missed the richness of life, the details of life, great increased sensibility. And along with that, a sense of rapport with things, no longer the sense of alienation and distinction. And this can go even so far as to the feeling of spiritual unity with things and a love for the world that before had seemed so nauseating and frightening and so forth. The loss of that fright that comes when you have found that your center is the same as the center of life, and so what is there to fear? As the old theologians would say, all rests well in God. This is something that comes, the affirmation of this horrendous thing that's the world, because it's not an easy thing to affirm. Just consider For millions, hundreds of millions of years, there had been life out there before eyes opened and saw it. And what they saw was life feeding on life, life eating life. The world is monstrous from the standpoint of consciousness. And one of the functions of the old rites is to bring about an affirmation of that thing, which is life, which is horrendous. And the rites of very primitive people, as well as far more developed people, typically are rites of sacrifice, murder, cruelty, the utmost brutality that would be utterly revolting, because that's what life is. And you've got to say yay to it or you can't live. And it's in about the 8th century B.C. that attitude of rejection comes along with what I call the great reversal, with the all life is sorrowful, let's pull out motif. And then there come these mythologies of pulling away. These are the two primary attitudes, either say yes or say no. In the Middle East, in the Near East, with Zoroastrianism and then also in Judaism and Christianity, you have the idea of an originally good creation. We're always good. And then through some fault of somebody or thing or other, it falls. And now we are in the process of a restoration. And there are people who are participating in this and people who are not. That's a in-between situation, which is awfully hard for us today to hold to. It's either an affirmation or a negation. You have Schopenhauer representing the latter when he said, life is something that should not have been. So the first function of myth is to help you to say yes to this horrific thing without guilt. The second function of a traditional mythology is to present an image of the cosmos, which will be, as we might say, up to date, and through which the sense of awe before the mystery dimension will come, so that every object in the world, as well as the whole world itself, becomes, as it were, a holy picture through which the realization can come of its marvel. The third function of a traditional mythology is to validate and support a specific social order. Now see what the situation is in our world. The social order is in terrific flux. There is no basis for it in absolute authority of any kind. It's not divinely inspired, and we know that. Furthermore, the cosmos we've assigned to our scientists. So here, the cosmological and the sociological functions have been taken away from the mythological sphere. The fourth function of a traditional mythology, and this is the one that's become acute and remains acute and will always be acute, is the psychological one of bringing an individual through the crises of his life. Now, the principal problem with the human being is that he is born 12 years too soon. No mother would regret this, but it does make a situation when an infant is utterly dependent for 12 years at least and doesn't reach physical maturity until the early 20s, dependent on parental authority. So that an attitude of dependency is established. All the reflex systems are of dependency and turning to authority and fear of punishment and so forth. At a certain period, every stimulus response has to be transformed into the assumption of authority, self-responsible authority, so that you don't drag over the parental imagery into your later years. There is an analogy for this in the animal world on the level of the marsupial. The marsupial is not a placental animal, and so the little fetus cannot stay in the womb very long. It has to be born long before it's ready. The little kangaroo is born after something like 18 days. It crawls up its mother's belly, tiny little thing, and into her pouch and attaches itself to a nipple there. The nipple swells in its mouth so that it can't get loose. And there it is in a second womb, as I like to say, a womb with a view. The function of mythology and the family is a womb with a view for the human infant that requires 12 or 13 years before it can come out of the pouch. Now, the point is that it should come out of the pouch. That is to say, you don't stay in the myth. The myth is something to mature your consciousness related to its tasks in life. The society formerly was always infected with mythological ideas, so that one was cathected to the society and held you there for the time of your mature life. Then comes this dreadful thing that just as soon as you learn how to do everything the society wants, and you're really beginning to be able to feel that you can do these things, it doesn't want you anymore. You're through. And so we have this terrible problem of the fallback of the psychological energies into the unconscious again, where they were. What Jung calls disposable libido is on your hands. It goes in and activates all those mythological images. Now, if they haven't been trained in childhood, you won't know where you are when they go back again. Then you become frightened, and this is the beginning of the nervous breakdown. Now, mythology has to take care of this simple life course. Give the individual his comfort and warmth and enrichment of growth so that his social and conscious life is not out of gear with his unconscious. Then hold him significantly to the society. Then find a place for him when the society is quit of him. Now, in the old days, they used to make people think the elders were wise, so they turned to them for advice. People don't do that anymore either. Even students will tell you what really is it today, and the old professor has to learn how to learn from his students. Then finally, there's the final exit, going out. There was a joke about Barnum Bailey Circus years ago. They had a freak show in the tent. People would pay $2.50 or something to go in and look at the freaks, and then they wouldn't leave because there'd be so many. This way to the bearded lady, this way to the fat man, and all that. And they didn't know how to get the people out of the tent until somebody thought, well, let's take down the exit sign and put up a sign to the grand egress. And then people would go to see the grand egress, and they'd be out. Well, now the mythology does that also, the grand egress. There will be the, all these fine people and so forth. Now, these four functions, two of them have been removed from the field of the religious and mythological life, the world of cosmology, the world of sociology. These have become scientifically and economically oriented. But the wonder and the psychology is still the field, and it is now the psychology of the individual flowering and flourishing. Now, with respect to the peculiar European situation, this is a very special world that we've inherited. It's a world in which respect and regard for the individual as a unique phenomenon has been paramount from at least the 12th century. I take that wonderful century. This is the century of the Arthurian romances and of the troubadour Amour and of the great cathedrals as the beginning of a real step away. Of course, we can look back to the world of the Greeks, and they also had this view of man. This was a non-priestly society of the Greeks. Our Western society has been essentially secular. The priest has been an alien here. He is like a minister on the golf course, trying to make you realize he's a good fellow, too. You know, you get that feeling also in the epics of Homer, Calchas. Performing his rites among all those big thugs. It's quite a different thing from the situation in the East, where the clergy were on top, the Brahmins and the monks and so forth, everybody highly respecting them and sincerely respecting them. Now, you know how it is. Any minister knows how it feels. The secular accent is ours. In the Greek world, the notion was that there was a norm for man. We have the beautiful standing nude as the representation of this marvel. But in our world, it's the unique individual, and there's no culture anywhere or art anywhere in the world with a portraiture like that of the Baroque and Renaissance artists. Think of a Titian, think of a Rembrandt, think of a Van Hals, any of these, and look for the counterparts elsewhere. And it's not simply how the human being looks. It's the rendition of the intelligible character, that inward life that is brought forth in these works. Now, this is to such an extent true that the condition which in most societies is normal was regarded in the Middle Ages as a wasteland situation. The wasteland theme in the Grail legend is the clue to our worldview, it seems to me. And T.S. Eliot recognized this in his poem in 1925 or whenever it was. In all other societies, and frequently in ours, marriages are made for familial or political or economic reasons. And the clergy then, in our civilization, sacramentalize these marriages, two bodies, one flesh, as though it had been love that had united them. It wasn't love, it was two bank books that were united, you might say. And this was something that was a desecration, from the Western point of view, of the miracle of love. Think what love means in the old traditions. Love is a biological matter, or a purely spiritual matter. Love your neighbor as yourself, completely impersonal, no matter who he is. And eros, you might say, is just the call of the organs to each other. It has nothing to do with exactly who it is. But amor, as defined by Guiraud de Bournay, for example, the great troubadour of the 12th century, the eyes are the scouts for the heart, and the eyes look for a beautiful image. They commute this image, communicate this to the heart, and if it is a noble heart, love will be born. Love as distinct from lust, or love as distinct from agape, personal, light world, confrontation of person to person. The whole troubadour movement was a revolt against the sacramentalization of marriage not based on love. And then we have also, earlier than that even, with Pelagius in the 4th and 5th centuries, his reply to Augustine, Augustine representing the Levantine view of the church. Original sin was inherited from our first parents. Pelagius, you can't inherit anybody's sin. Augustine, salvation from sin comes through the sacramental system of the church. Salvation does not come from an institution, it comes from the individual. This is the theme of the Grail romances of the 12th century, and particularly in Wolfram von Eschenbach's Parsifal. The maimed king of the Grail represents exactly a person who did not earn his role. He inherited his role of king. King not simply of a country, king as the one guarding the highest spiritual symbol. A fine young man, he had inherited the role, and instead of representing the role because he hadn't earned it spiritually, he goes out singing love. And he comes against a pagan warrior who is coming in quest of the Grail. The warrior coming from the suburbs of paradise. You have the nature man seeking the spirit man seeking nature. They collide. The pagan is killed, and the young king is castrated. He has lost his nature, and that was the sense of the wasteland. Europe has lost its nature by impugning nature, by calling every natural act a corrupt act. They had separated the spirit from nature, and the only solution was going to come from one who, in perfect innocence, living his own life with a noble heart and a spiritual heart, would show and make evident that spirit is the flower of nature and not its counterpart, and comes from man. That's the same message I spoke of with respect to man on the moon. The spiritual realm and the human realm are of one order. And we have this wonderful, wonderful legend of the great fool, Parsifal, bungling along, hurting people right and left because he's so clumsy, nobody really seriously hurt, refusing offered marriage of a young woman who was offered to him by his teacher of courtly battle, and coming to his own bride, whom he found and saved from her destiny of having to marry a king who wanted her simply for her kingdom. And then, having fulfilled his life as a warrior, as a husband, as a father, going forth to the spiritual life, which was a fulfillment of the physical, not a substitute for it at all, and coming to the castle of the Grail. And here is where I come to the final point. He comes to the castle of the Grail King, the maimed king, and he's moved by the question, what ails you? Why? How do you suffer? What is this? The king was in terrible pain. But he had been taught a knight does not ask questions. And so, in order, on this one occasion, to present the image of a polite, courtly knight, he did not let his nature dictate what he should do, and there was disaster right and left. Whenever Parsifal did what he had been taught to do, instead of what his noble nature told him to do, things got worse. The whole sense of the Grail is, out of nature comes the spirit. And you just read that, the Parsifal of Wolfram von Eschenbach. There's a beautiful edition of it now. And it's a glorious story of nature in its spiritual fulfillment. What is the sense of the question? And here I come to the final point. Schopenhauer asks, how is it that a person, through experiencing the pain and danger of another, can so forget his own safety that he goes to that other person's rescue at the risk of his own life? How come that the laws of nature can be so suspended that a person will forget the first law of nature, self-protection, and turn to another? I think of this when I see these photos coming over the TV of those wonderful boys in their helicopters going to rescue some companion whom they don't even know who's been shot down. Beyond the call of duty, Schopenhauer's answer is, this experience of compassion, Mitleid, is an experience of the truth, namely that you and that other are one. That the mere empirical experience of your separateness is the secondary experience. The primary experience, the breakthrough, is to go past that. So he announces compassion as the only metaphysical experience. This goes along with that LSD thing I was talking about, where the person loses the sense of his ego structure, his ego integrity, and opens out to another level of consciousness. The problem is, though, to try to hold your balance between the two. There is a time for one thing and there's a time for another. There's a, the question of the Grail Knight then was to be moved by compassion. And yet he allowed his social image, his ego image as a knight, to cut that off. Well, he went through a great ordeal of turning from God, turning from man, solitary, world renunciation and all that, until finally he broke through again, came back to the castle and solved the story. I won't tell the story all the way. To conclude, there's a amusing Indian story about a young man who had experienced the unity of all. His guru had told him, you are the divine, tattvamasi, you are it. Let's say God, you are God. And the tree is God, and I am God, and all that. Oh, he was filled with the depth of this experience and inflated by it, and goes out for a walk to meditate on this. He sees coming down the dusty road a great elephant with the howdah on it, and the mahout, the elephant driver, seated on the head, and the boy is walking along, and he sees the elephant coming, and he says, and the mahout's hollering, get out of the way, you idiot. And he's saying, I am God. The elephant is God. Should God get out of the way of God? And with this metaphysical meditation, he finally comes to a physical confrontation. And the elephant, marvelous beast, wraps his trunk around this kid, throws him off the road, and walks on. Well, he was slightly injured physically, devastated psychologically, and he comes back to his guru in this dilapidated condition. The guru looks at him and says, well, what's the matter with you? He said, well, he told him the story. He said, you told me that I was God. Yes, you are God. That the elephant was God. Yes, the elephant is God. Should God get out of the way of God? Well, why didn't you listen to the voice of God telling you to get out of the way? This is the problem of the two worlds. Now, in conclusion, I take as my occidental image this wonderful saying that occurred in a 12th century book called The Book of the 24 Philosophers and was quoted by this wonderful man, Nicholas Cusanus, a couple of centuries later, with respect to the nature of God. God, he says, is an intelligible sphere whose circumference is nowhere and whose center is everywhere. That is, the individual, again, stressed as the center, 12th century to the very present when it has been demonstrated. So my feeling is that the old myths and new myths in our present world, insofar as there is an overall common experience, can be said to require the recognition of man as the center, man as the giver of meanings, man as the source of all the gods and all the hells, and man as that one who must be recognized in love as the sign to yourself of your own transcendence, of your own secondary ego order.
You heard Professor Campbell movingly introduce this topic by reflecting on his life lived in the study of myth, immersing himself in the mythic narratives, and grateful for, I suspect, finding in myth the consolations for the human, all too human moments when life is difficult and challenging, when we feel raw, vulnerable, and we realize that the pathways to wisdom, as well as to ourselves, are lonely and require us to travel away from the herd. He's also aware of, as he says, the problems of the moment, and how these problems, among others, are related to shattered mythological images and symbols. Just as there are today, when Professor Campbell delivered this lecture in February of 1976, confounding, threatening, and seemingly insurmountable problems were threatening global and individual stability. In the 12 months prior to the talk we just listened to, genocide was initiated in Cambodia by the Khmer Rouge. Political terrorism was becoming a chillingly familiar aspect of life around the world. Saigon fell, functionally ending the Vietnam War. Two assassination attempts were made against President Ford, and a Rembrandt painting was slashed a dozen times while hanging in an Amsterdam museum by an unemployed schoolteacher. The Troubles, the armed conflict between the Irish Republican Army and British forces, was approaching its most intense period. With this background, Professor Campbell acknowledged the different experiences that the scholars of myth have versus the problems of people living day to day in what he called a terminal moraine of mythological thinking. The scholar of myth, Campbell himself, for instance, still has the benefit of finding an orienting perspective in the myths they study. In Campbell's case, I believe it was his conviction that the power and the beauty of myth is its ability to illustrate the human capacity for transcendence. But for those who aren't scholars of myth, who aren't philosophers or artists or cultural historians, living in this terminal moraine of mythic images may easily lead one to a sense of disorganization, marginalization, persecution, ridicule, and existential loneliness, because they no longer have the comforting support of traditions that serve to explain their world to them and define for them their place in it. I think this absence of myth deserves a deeper, more nuanced discussion, especially since it may seem to many these days that we are drowning in myth. The mythic traditions that we've inherited no longer function, and influenced by the knowledge of how they inspired and facilitated the rise of the great civilizations, we intuitively want, it seems to me, to search for new mythologies and sacred stories to fill the void, hoping they will be relevant to the contemporary world we now live in. Presently, it isn't at all unusual to hear people talk of emerging contemporary myths or contemporary mythologies. People speak of the Star Wars movies as contemporary mythology. And likewise, some fans import the Star Trek ethos into their personal lives and conduct themselves as though they were members of Starfleet, sometimes going as far as to wear Star Trek-inspired uniforms to work, or to jury duty or other social functions. Adherents of various religious traditions are more vocal than they've been in a long time. The casual observer might be led to believe that there are emerging mythologies all over the place. But these are not new mythologies. Rather, they're examples of what I would call post-mythic structures. They are relics of dead or dying mythologies, which sometimes, dressed in modern garments, emit the aroma of archaic bewilderment and fascination. Fear and trembling, as Kierkegaard put it. They hint at a sense of religious importance inserted into the midst of a modernized society, which is largely oriented to the systematic eradication of mythical thought. There are countless examples of post-mythic structures operating in contemporary life, ranging from militant fundamentalist evangelicalism to uniquely American notions of rugged individualism and fantasies that frame the United States as the biblical shining city on the hill. However, you just heard Campbell himself say that there is no myth. There can be no more myth. Indeed, he used those very words. You see, it takes a very long time to make a myth. And not only does it take a long time, it requires an homogeneous population living in a specific place, having shared experiences, including a shared set of feeling reference and a common history. These, in addition to ritual, are the necessary foundations of a living mythology. And these are conditions that can no longer be replicated in the modern world. We're too diverse in experience and background. Our focus shifts remarkably fast, and the world moves and changes at a mind-numbing speed. Contemporary narratives and images like Star Wars are not the spontaneous archetypal expressions of myth, but are instead conscious, intentional narratives designed to recall and reflect ancient mythologies. Post-mythic structures, as I called them before. And these post-mythic structures are inserted, rather awkwardly, I might add, into contemporary life and society. I say awkwardly because contemporary life is largely dominated by STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, disciplines that are, by their very nature, antithetical to mythical thought. The cognitive dissonance created by the collision between materialism and immaterialism, or between logical positivism and the mysterium tremendum, that great mystery of existence, continues to provoke tectonic trembling deep in the unutterable recesses of life, creating anxious, confusing instabilities in individuals, in social order, and in cultures. Post-mythic structures, or so-called modern mythologies, are too self-consciously aware, too intentional. They want too much to be myths for them to actually be myths. Because myths are an unconscious creation of the human psyche. What's more, the self-consciousness of the post-mythic structures, the awareness that the narratives or images are reaching for mythic affectations, diminishes their metaphorical power and emotional impact, and undermines their own authority. At worst, the devotee appears to be delusional, or perhaps the victim of some variety of flimflam. Walter Benjamin's well-known essay on the work of art in the age of mechanical reproduction has something to teach us about the contemporary treatments of myth. His treatment of art in this essay is remarkably relevant to understanding the contemporary desire for a new mythology, and serves as a particularly apt analogy. Especially analogous to Benjamin's thinking about art are those cases in which myths have died, leaving only a corpse. In other words, they're post-mythic structures, and are proclaimed without regard for the circumstances of life, for the people, the time, and the places that facilitated their emergence, and are transformed into analogies and facts that would have been unimaginable in their original context. Professor Campbell pointed out that symbols are communicated from the unconscious psyche to consciousness, and when they are refuted by one's own conscious experience of the world, it is as if, Campbell says, the connection to the source, or one's ground of being, is severed. It's important to remember that myths first existed in relationship to ritual, whether magical or religious or both, and to the extent that the myth had efficacy in the world, its archetypal force was volatilized by a connection to its original enactments. Expecting the myth to live, decontextualized in contemporary settings, removes its connection to ritual, and subsequently removes any meaningful participation in mythic life and thought. Because ritual is cumbersome, complicated, and time-consuming, myth becomes immensely more accessible without it, and popular once it's separated from its dependence upon ritual. But the consequence of its newly acquired popularity is that the myth loses the gravitas of authenticity. And, Benjamin insists, instead of being based on ritual, it begins to be based on another practice, politics. In this situation, myth is casually and frequently referred to in insubstantial, erroneous, or intentionally misleading ways, giving rise to characterizations that result in the misconstrued myth's viral spread via lushly adorned quotes on social media sites, in therapy groups, in yoga studios, in motivational speeches, and appears as the subject of vapid, schmaltzy books by self-help authors. Myth, as we know, is inciting, inspiring, and remarkably useful and relevant. But the power of myth, disconnected from its ethical structures, in other words, disconnected from its rituals, makes post-mythic structures potent and savage weapons of propaganda. Let me insert a rather longish quote from Campbell's Masks of God, Volume 4, Creative Mythology. "Clearly, mythology is no toy for children," Campbell writes. "Nor is it a matter of archaic, merely scholarly concern, of no moment to modern men of action. For its symbols, whether in the tangible form of images or in the abstract form of ideas, touch and release the deepest centers of motivation, moving literate and illiterate alike, moving mobs, moving civilizations. There is a real danger, therefore, in the incongruity of focus that has brought the latest findings of technological research into the foreground of modern life, joining the world in a single community, while leaving the anthropological and psychological discoveries from which a commensurable moral system might have been developed in the learned publications where they first appeared. For surely it is folly to preach to children who will be riding rockets to the moon a morality and a cosmology based on the concepts of the good society and of man's place in nature that were coined before the harnessing of the horse. And the world is now far too small, and men's stake in sanity too great, for any more of those old games of chosen folk, whether of Jehovah, Allah, Votan, Manu, or the devil, by which tribesmen were sustained against their enemies in the days when the serpent still could talk." Now, not only do we get a taste of Campbell's literary skill, but we have to ask the question, what do we do now that myth seems to have fled from the world? What uses remain for these old corpses, the corpus of myth? Professor Campbell himself said that, of his four functions of myth, the second and third functions, the cosmological and the sociological functions, no longer have authority in modern life. The cosmological functions of myth have been superseded by the physical sciences. Astrophysics has triumphed over astrology. Just as an evolving secular law based on the changing needs of a society has triumphed over divine fiat, that leaves us with the metaphysical function, which inspires a sense of awe and wonder at the mysteries of existence, and the psychological function. The psychological function is the key to understanding mythology in contemporary life. Let me say that one more time. The psychological function is the key to understanding mythology in contemporary life. The psychological function allows one to, quoting Campbell, reinterpret, re-experience, and reuse the great mythical traditions that science in the conditions of modern life had rendered useless, uncoupled as they are from their cosmological and sociological reference points. And to avail ourselves of this function of mythology, the psychological function, we must turn inward and discover what awaits us in our own interior landscape, rather than just simply proselytizing to our neighbors. Clearly, Professor Campbell teaches us that mythologies everywhere come from and relate to the psyche. And the psychological task that then falls to each one of us is to reconnect to these images and narratives of myth psychologically, using the traditional symbols of myth as objects of meditation, reverie, or creative inspiration, discovering what they say to you personally rather than what they're supposed to say or what they've traditionally said, and allow them to help you find your passion, the ideas and insights that will sustain you when life becomes challenging, encourage you to live the life that realizes your talent and potential. C.G. Jung recognized the importance of this challenge as well, and in the foreword to the fourth edition of Symbols of Transformation, he writes, "I simply had to know what unconscious or preconscious myth was forming me, from what rhizome I sprang." For Jung, individual consciousness is the seasonal flowering of the perennial rhizome that lies beneath the earth. It's the material expression of the autotonic generative force that makes life possible. And myth is the alchemical container fostering the transformation of consciousness and the goal of making us more aware of the energies of life that live us. The symbols of myth are always grounded in the archetypes of the unconscious. But their form, their appearance, and their specific content are filled in by the experiences and ideas each individual and each culture consciously has. Jungian analysis is conceived to increase conscious awareness and thereby make our roots, our psychic depths, more apparent and more recognizable, which then helps us become more congruent and more whole as human beings. And there we discover our passion. There we discover who we are. And then we discover our zeal for life. When we discover our zeal, as Campbell put it, and the gifts that attend it, we discover a simultaneous desire to bring those gifts into the world. And the greatest gift we can give to the world is ourselves. Ourselves presented without artifice, without sentiment, without self-deception. This is the antidote to authoritarianism, to racial bias, rapacious greed and intimidation, perpetual grievance, and the malignant coarseness and cruelty to which I referred at the beginning of this commentary. Offering ourselves to the world from one's zeal, from one's passion, no longer bears the trappings of an ego or a power trip, or the hope of a monetary bonanza. The offering of oneself to the world is made with awe and delight, with privilege and with reverence, not only for the mystery of existence, but for the play of life itself. If you love, you will evoke love in return. Your trust in others and in the world will elicit trust in yourself and a real sense of the world's embrace. The beauty you find everywhere will also be found in you. The discovery of one's personal myth has the potential to connect oneself to others, to life, and to the world as it is. Subsequently, one's relationship to the world will be magnificently human and humane. And the gifts you bring to the world will not be fashioned from what you have, but from who you are. Thank you for listening. And I'll be back next month with a new Joseph Campbell lecture on the Joseph Campbell Foundation's podcast, Pathways with Joseph Campbell.
Pathways with Joseph Campbell is a production of the Joseph Campbell Foundation and the Mythmaker Podcast Network, and is produced by John Booker and Elias Smirnoff. Executive producer, Robert Walter. Your host has been Bradley Olson. Editing and audio services provided by Seth Balin. Music exclusively provided by APM Music. For more podcasts and information about Joseph Campbell, please visit jcf.org.